Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks to the passage of time, as well as books and movies, our perceptions of the Civil War have been sanitized, romanticized. A new book from Michael C.C. Adams, a retired professor of history at Northern Kentucky University, brings us back to reality. He's joining me in the studio right now to discuss Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War, a new book published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Michael Adams, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I think this station is a feather in our city's cap, and I'm grateful to be with you.
Well, thank you. I greatly appreciate that compliment. Well, I wanted to begin by saying after I read your book, I'll never think about the Civil War the same way.
Thank you.
Living Hell brings back not only the pain and suffering, but really the harsh realities that people faced in the middle of the 19th century, just in day-to-day life. Why did you think it was important to remind people of these harsh realities?
It's a good question, and I think you covered it in your introduction. We have a tendency over time to romanticize the past. I even think when I go on a vacation, it can be close to living hell. But a year later, I find that it was wonderful. So I felt that with so much armed conflict in our situation, we ought occasionally to just leave aside the more, if you like, glorious aspects, noble aspects, and look at the terrible destruction that war brings. And for America, I think that the best place to go for this is the Civil War, because it was the last time America was a battleground. I'm from Britain originally, and I think if you're European, you go to World War I. Mm-hmm. That was for Europe, the great debacle. But the Civil War was so very, very bloody. Today, men in uniform who died would be the equivalent of 2% of our population. And that's just the men in uniform, not the civilians, not those who were wounded, left injured, and so on.
Well, you've structured the book in such a way that you examine all facets of life during the Civil War, including the military camps that shocked so many soldiers when they signed up for the glory of the battle. And here, right in the beginning of the book, you start out with what are some pretty disgusting conditions when it comes to having a large amount of people in one place.
Yes. I compare it to a city moving across the landscape. And these are, as you said, the dirty details. If we were to imagine downtown Cincinnati suddenly moving across Ohio, what do you do about sanitary arrangements? How do you get water? You drink the wells dry, then you drink muddy puddles, you drink bloody puddles. The horses could not be taught to use a latrine, obviously, and I've forgotten the exact figure, but I think they could lay 20 pounds of manure each or more a day. Food became very hard. And what I tried to do in the book, again, you put your finger on, I tried to walk the reader through that landscape to see the dirt, the flies, the decaying bodies. And as you know, for example, in Virginia, they fought over the same ground year after year, so that as they came back and they were looking for a water supply, they were drinking groundwater, which was absolutely polluted by the decaying bodies of the previous years. And so it is a very grim experience that they went through, and no wonder that, you know, the number of men who died of disease outnumbered those who died of wounds 2-1.
It's very interesting in the book as you talk about these mass movements of troops, and this is on both sides of the war, both the North and the South, how they go along and they are consuming the resources as they go, and once some of these armies get out ahead of their supply train, that they were even deeper trouble.
Yes, absolutely. It's a vivid comment that I have remembered since I read it years ago, that a Union civilian who went over the battlefield of Antietam or Sharpsburg in September of 1862 said you could tell where the rebel lines had been because there was a row of green corn husks, and behind it, a line of dysenteric stool. Lee, who was very offensive-minded, had run out beyond his supply lines. His men were eating green corn, and they had terrible dysentery. It's all they had to eat. And so this created huge problems. And even when, you know, they had the supplies, the biscuit, for example, called hardtack, if it got wet, worms came out in abundance, and the bacon was rancid and so on.
Well, I have to say that one line about the green corn stuck in my mind,
stayed
too, after reading
you.
The book. Matter of fact, I related it to my producer, Pete Reitmeier, right before our interview here. I'm talking with Michael Adams, author of Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War, available where books are sold right now. If you have a question for Michael, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us, talk@wvxu.org. So malnutrition, bad food, exposure to the elements, dirt, disease, bugs, lack of water. This list is long, and you just keep piling it on as the further I got into the book.
I know. It was cruel, really. But I felt it was necessary because so often, even in very good Civil War books that deal with the horror of battle and so on, we will glance at something and then pass on to look at the strategy or whatever. And I felt perhaps it was time to pile on. As I mentioned in the introduction, you know, Walt Whitman, the great poet, said, "The real war will never get in the books," and he meant the savagery towards the end, the suffering. At one point, he called America one great hospital and then again a great graveyard, with all these unknown graves. And I thought the only way that one can feel how terrible it was is to pile on. Though I admit I did it deliberately, and it was cruel.
And some of these letters are fascinating. The accounts that they do, that they bring, and you keep them as they were written. You know, you mentioned in the introduction of the book that you're going to leave the grammar the way the grammar is, even when it's improper spelling the way it is. And it's that I found as eye-opening in seeing what the level of literacy was, if you may, back in that day.
I think, again, you put your finger right on it. And I must say, just parenthetically, I know one of the reasons I love your interviews is you read the books very carefully.
Thank you.
And you've obviously done that here. I think one reason we go back to the American Civil War is that both sides spoke English, both were literate, and they were not censored. One of the things I came out of this project feeling strongly is we stereotype the Victorians when we say that they repressed everything. Some of the letters, diaries, and memoirs are startling in what they talk about. You know, a soldier saying that there had been counter-battery fire between different guns, and the damage was so great that many of the gunners was almost nothing left but shreds of flesh in the trees. And even sex, which we all believe the Victorians didn't talk about, it is there. One that struck me very much and has stayed with me. A Southern soldier who became a minister after the war of religion, he was so shaken by it all, described the troops, the rebels, marching along. And at the side of the road was a young girl crawling along, shouting obscenities at them. She was obviously brain damaged, and I think, to be very honest, it came from venereal disease. She had either prostituted herself to survive or had been raped. And the soldiers, in a sense, thought this was funny, and he records in his memoir how that evening a party of them threw her off a tall bridge to her death in a gorge. Now, this is right there in his published memoirs, and we don't expect this of the Victorians, but they said a great deal that I'm not sure today would be very well accepted.
Your accounts of camp life talks about those soldiers looking for sex, using prostitutes.
Yes.
And you describe at one point how many of the soldiers perceived that half the garrison was out arresting and taking the other half of the garrison to the brig most of the time. And this was really the way the soldiers were trying to cope with these horrible conditions.
Yes, exactly. The provost marshal general's corps, if you like, grows and grows on both sides because they're trying to keep control of the armies. And it got so bad that General Marcina Rudolph Patrick, who was the provost marshal general of the Union Army of the Potomac, stood on the gallows after he had hanged two soldiers for rape and lectured the assembled troops to try to get over to them that this was not a perk, it was not a sport that went with the war, but a horrible crime. And it did take place. Earlier authors have often said that what we saw in the Civil War was symbolic rape. That is to say, a guerrilla would take out the male of a household from the other side, shoot him in front of his family, or throw him into the burning house. And this was a kind of symbolic rape. We had that, but we also had real rape, especially of black women. Both sides thought, sadly, that African-American women were fair game.
I'm speaking with Michael Adams, the author of Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War. Michael is a retired professor from Northern Kentucky University with a number of military history books under his belt. This is just the newest. You can learn more about it at wvxu.org. You know, it was shocking as you led me through the book how much the soldiers on both sides suffered even before they get to these horrible battlefields.
Yes, this is absolutely true. Being on the march was very hard, and as we were just saying, many of them did get out of hand. It was their first time away from home, and they did things that at home they couldn't have got away with. The punishments were terrible. By our standards, they're absolutely ferocious. Bucking and gagging, tying to a cannon wheel in a kind of crucifixion, even shooting, and shooting was theater of the macabre. They would march or ride the prisoner, seat on his coffin to the place of execution, let him sit on the coffin while the firing squad loaded, and they went through a very painful process of reading the crime to the assembled troops. And then they would shoot him. Sometimes it was quite painful. That I quote a story of a young boy, a rebel, who simply had enough. We would today call it combat exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
And he had tried to go home. Many of those boys were underage. I think this boy was perhaps 14, 15. And as the bullets hit him, he just had time to scream, "Oh God," and that was it.
You talk about some of the soldiers suffering from what they diagnosed, they called nostalgia,
yes,
which is, I just need to go home, and dying of homesickness.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the accounts. And with all these conditions and the lack of food and poor shelter, it's surprising there weren't more deserters. You do speak about some of the ones who did go home,
yes,
and would run, but it's surprising that a lot stuck to their game.
They did. I think they were used, as you mentioned at the top of the show or the interview, to a lot more suffering in their daily lives than we can endure today. I even notice in dentistry that the hot drills and the lack of anesthetic we had as children that gave us dental trauma. Now my grandchildren think having their teeth polished is a terrible, painful imposition.
Yes.
So we, I think, are not in some ways as tough. And one instance I give of that in the book that I still admire, I've come over the course of a career to think that war is an awfully destructive business. But I can admire the courage. And the generals in particular showed enormous capacity for suffering. And they would be hit, they would go home, come back without an arm or leg, mangled in the face, return to their positions, get hit again, go home, and finally be killed. So I think one has to admire their capacity for suffering.
Well, our producer Pete was asking why the soldiers just kept at it. You know, was it a sense of honor? I mean, why yes. did they stick with it even though there was all this suffering?
It's a good question, and it operates at several levels. I think one is personal pride. Second is pride in the unit, something we still today put a lot of emphasis on, not letting your buddies down. A third, in a period when units recruited locally, was that you could be posted at home. I use an instance in the book of a boy, I think he was Kentucky or Tennessee, who ran in his first battle. He could not go home again because everybody wrote home and said, well, Dan is a stinking coward. And then the last thing that we often don't like to talk about, but the officers and the non-coms, the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, corporals, stood behind the battle line, either with the officers' drawn swords, pistols, or rifles. And they would run through or shoot men who ran. And if you got by the officers, they often had cavalry behind them. And they would cut you down. Hmm. So there are a number of issues. But a lot did desert. You know, one of the reasons that Lee said he lost his 1862 campaign was that a huge number of his army just melted away between the lack of food and the terrible, terrible conditions of battle in that campaign. They just melted away.
I loved in the closing where you quote a fellow named John B. Jones by saying, will this generation, with their eyes open and their memories fresh, ever, ever go to war again? Talking about how they start with a great fervor for the war, but soon it's all anti-war.
It became anti-war, particularly in the South, because they took a pasting. One example, and it's a complex one, because with the end of slavery, a great humane advance, nevertheless, Kentucky, the instance I'm going to mention, did lose a large capital investment in the slave system. But Kentucky, as an example, in the 1860 national census, ranked in the top 10 of states by per capita income. After 1870, it was in the bottom 10. Hmm. And that was not a coincidence. And, you know, that even showed up in my career. We were constantly making do with shortfall budgets in the state system. And so they did become anti-war. Something that I find a little bit saddening is, however, how quickly we forget how awful war is, and we go on to the next one, as you know, having read the book so carefully, is that I chart that by 1876, when Custer dies on the Little Bighorn, Walt Whitman, who had said how awful the war had been, is praising this as a wonderful act of self-sacrifice in America's saga. So it doesn't last long.
Michael C.C. Adams is a retired professor of history from Northern Kentucky University. You can find his book, Living Hell, The Dark Side of the Civil War, in bookstores and on our website, wvxu.org. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you. I've appreciated it.